There are so many issues throughout all levels of government that smart Christians need to view it as a way to care for our neighbor by making good decisions.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation with her husband, Mark, at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The federal government has gotten much more involved in family formation or family destruction, abortion, other issues. And there are so many ways in which it's important for us to think about how we can defend the weak and vulnerable among us by making good decisions.
You can watch journalists Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christian political engagement at this year's Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes the ability to watch a live stream and a recording. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
I'm afraid that at this point on subjects of politics, especially if it has anything to do with morality, culture, and religion, and Donald Trump, I'm afraid you're just going to have to do careful reading.
These Puritans, and I mean that not in the sense of Christian Puritans, but in ideological Puritans, they keep trying to purify themselves to the point where they outdo one another, and in the end, they have to eat one another. They literally are killing each other.
The culture is going to turn around, it seems, more and more to go after classical Christians. In a time of soft totalitarianism, as Rod Dreher calls it, or just outright persecution.
Lutherans could say, hold on, hold your horses here. Look back at the fathers. Here, listen to what they said. And that thus they were able to show that they were not teaching something novel, not teaching something heretical.
On-demand listeners of Issues Etc. love hearing sound theology while walking the dog.
You have probably seen something about this in the news. Here is a headline from the Wall Street Journal. Hagia Sophia has reverted to a mosque. It shows a picture of a lovely building from inside under a rotunda dome. If you look carefully, you can see that the writing on the walls is not in fact Christian, but it's Arabic, very stylized Arabic, indicating that, well, it once was a mosque and now will be a mosque again after being a museum for some time. But it was originally a church. In fact, not just any old church. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, July the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about Christianity, Islam, and the history of the Hagia Sophia with Matt Phillips. He's professor of history at Concordia University in Nebraska. A little bit later, we'll be remembering Matriarch Ruth. Her story is fascinating, but it's kind of complicated and needs some explanation, too. Dr. Kevin Golden, PhD in Biblical Studies with an emphasis on Old Testament from Concordia Seminary, will be explaining all of it to us. You can join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about Christianity, Islam, and the history of the Hagia Sophia, Dr. Matt Phillips. He's professor of history at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Todd.
So, people are probably reading about the Hagia Sophia in the news. What is this building?
Well, it's a building, one of the most significant works of human architecture in history. No, I don't think anybody would argue with me about that. It was originally built in the early 500s as a new building, as a new church building for the Patriarch of Constantinople, by Justinian, one of the great Byzantine emperors, Eastern Roman Imperial emperors. And that's when the original Hagia Sophia was built. Although there was a church on that spot, there were, I think, at least two other churches on that spot. So that spot was not new. Kind of like today, the Roman Basilica where the Pope is, that was the same place where there were previous churches. So it was the same then. There was actually, the older church was destroyed in a riot, or greatly destroyed, so he just decided to build a new one. And that is still basically the structure obviously there's been a lot of centuries and renovations and changes made to it. But basically the structure that was built, and the architectural design is extremely influential. I think, if I remember correctly, it was the largest Christian church, largest Christian cathedral, until the completion of one of the cathedrals in Spain in the 1500s. So as far as just space inside it. So it's a very famous building. It was converted to a mosque in 1453 when Mehmet II, known as Mehmet the Conqueror, the Ottoman ruler, conquered Constantinople, finally, for the Turks anyway, finally. And it was converted to a mosque. It served as a mosque until, I would say, about 1930 or so, maybe 1920s. And the new Republic of Turkey, led by a man named that we know as Ataturk, Mustafa Kemal, the first president of modern Turkey, who wanted to secularize Turkey in many ways politically, changed it into a museum. And it served as a museum until, well, you know, pretty recently, right? There have been some prayers in it before, Muslim prayers in it before. And there was one instance in 1919, I found out today, of a Greek priest sneaking in there with some Greek military guys, and they actually performed a liturgy surreptitiously and snuck out. And that's the only instance of that I know of Christian worship in that building, formal Christian worship in that building, from 1453 to 2020.
Why is this building in the news today?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the current president of Turkey, Erdogan, I think it's the way you pronounce it, he decided a couple of years back that he wanted to convert it back to a mosque, essentially, or at least have it used as a mosque. I think he's still trying to skate a middle road in a way now, saying, yes, it'll be used as a mosque, but Christians and others will be able to come visit it, because it is a huge tourist site. It's one of the largest tourist sites in the world. So if you go to Istanbul, right, it's in Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, this is one of the things most people see. It's like going to Rome and seeing the Colosseum or whatever, you know. So they don't want to lose that, I don't think. But he does want to play to much of his political base in Turkey today, which is the more, I would say, pro-Islamist side of Turkey. This is a political act for him. There's no doubt about that. He's president of the country, so it's a political act. He's trying to shore that up, too. And that doesn't mean he doesn't believe it, either. I'm not saying he's not sincere. I think he's probably a sincere Muslim and believes it was the great mosque of Istanbul, and it still should be. I think that's probably his position. But it also does help him politically, at least with his base.
So what role originally did the Hagia Sophia play in the Byzantine world?
I mean, it was the center, it was the main church for the Byzantine Empire. It is the cathedral of the patriarch of the Byzantine church, what we usually refer to as the Orthodox Church in the East, or the main Orthodox Church for the history from since Constantine, right, until today. The Orthodox patriarch is still in Istanbul, but after the Ottoman Turks took it over, who were Muslim, obviously, they moved him to another church, and they decided to convert this church into a mosque. So its significance was amazing, and its cultural significance is amazing. It was damaged through earthquakes over time. It was renovated in the 10th century with amazing artwork in it. Unfortunately, some Western Christians came and sacked Constantinople and harmed Hagia Sophia quite a bit, the building, and what's known as the Fourth Crusade. A lot of that was restored later, and then, of course, the Ottoman Turks took it in 1453, converted it into a mosque. It was also renovated in the 19th century, when it was still the Ottoman Empire, by one of the sultans, one of the rulers. So a lot of the current things inside the building actually go back to that renovation.
Was it a common practice when the Ottoman Empire was vying with the West militarily and politically to, if they conquered a place, turned the church or the cathedral into a mosque?
Yes, that was fairly common practice. We see this a lot in human history. I mean, Christians turned Roman buildings into churches before. I'm not trying to equivocate. I'm just, you know, saying this happened. It's somewhat natural in a way, right? It's a good way to convince the people, you know, we're in control now. But yes, it was a very common thing, to make a shorter answer. It was a very common thing among Muslims in general to convert churches into mosques. They didn't always do it. There was forms of tolerance in different Muslim societies, no doubt about that, for Christians anyway. But yes, it was very common. And I actually was talking to a friend earlier today in preparation who studied some of the Balkan areas where in Southern Europe where the Turks ruled. And he said sometimes as the areas would change sides, they would be reconverted back one way or another. So that would be later, like in the 17th century. So an area would be conquered by the Ottomans. They would make the building into a mosque. Some Christian group would come back, maybe Serbians or somebody, and they would make it back into a church. So buildings actually went back and forth like that.
Was it ever common, and we'll talk about the Crusades on the other side of the break, but was it ever common during the time of the Crusades for Christians who conquered Muslim areas to turn their mosques, originally mosques, into churches?
They certainly did it in Spain. Off the top of my head, that's the best examples I could think of, as known as the Spanish Reconquest from the Christian side. You know, because Spain, what we know as Spain and Portugal for much of the Middle Ages, was actually ruled by Muslims. And as Christian armies and others reconquered, in quotes, those parts, well, they did reconquer it, not to put that in quotes, I guess, they reconquered it, they would change buildings into churches. Sometimes those had been buildings, right, that had been converted into mosques to begin with, or new mosques that had been built. I think the most famous one would be in Cordoba in southern Spain. So it was made into a Christian church again. In the Middle East, a lot of the churches that existed, I mean, there were already churches there, right? Like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The Muslims had not completely done away with that. Although one example might be the mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. When Christians ruled Jerusalem in the 12th century, I'm pretty sure they didn't allow Muslims to come pray there. Those were used for other purposes. So yes, you did have somewhat of a back and forth like that in different places.
We're talking about Christianity, Islam, and the history of the Hagia Sophia. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest professor of history at Concordia University, Nebraska. We'll talk about the long time of the Crusades and its relationship to Hagia Sophia next. What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
In many ways, St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Bel Air, Maryland, is just like any other Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod Church. They have worship services each Sunday and reach out to their community, but one thing they don't do is pay their electric bill. Hello, this is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. And if you want to hear what St. Matthew actually did to eliminate their electric bill, just visit interesttime.org. That's interesttime.org.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest, professor of history at Concordia University, Nebraska. We're talking about Christianity, Islam, and the history of the Hagia Sophia. So you need to clear some of the misconceptions about the Crusades up a little bit before we talk about the role of Hagia Sophia. First of all, the Crusades is a really long period of time.
Right? Yes. I would remind you and your listeners that you and I did a week-long series on the Crusades. I thought, man, that might have been 10 years ago now, right? And I assume they can look that up on your podcast histories. And I know I was the one doing it, but I thought it was decent. If somebody just wants to get a kind of a basic overview of the Crusades, they can go back and listen to those.
So during this long period that we refer to as the Crusades, what was the role of the Hagia Sophia?
Yeah, so I mean, it's simply what the role of the Constantinople was, right? And the Byzantine Empire. It was the church that was the center of the Byzantine Empire. And the Byzantine Empire was the impetus for much of the reason for what became the Crusades initially, right? The reason why the Western Christian warriors went east in the late 11th century originally was to partially fight for the Byzantine Empire against the attacks of Muslim Turks. Now, when they conquered an area, but while they were initially allies, and they were allies off and on during the Crusade period, the Western Christians and the Byzantine Eastern Christians didn't always get along. The worst example of that, of course, is the Fourth Crusade, when the Crusade went badly off course and sacked Constantinople. My PhD advisor who lives there in St. Louis, Tom Madden, wrote a whole book about that called The Fourth Crusade, if anybody's interested. And that is directly related to Hagia Sophia because for about 60 years, the Patriarch of Constantinople was actually what's called the Latin Patriarch, which means that he recognized the authority of the Pope and he was connected to Rome. And that person would have used the Hagia Sophia. And unfortunately, in 1204, the Hagia Sophia, along with the rest of Constantinople, was ransacked and looted by the army that was the Fourth Crusade. So a lot of the relics, religious objects, and other things were taken to the West during that period. Probably, ironically, a lot of them were probably preserved because of that reason, because when the Muslims did finally take Constantinople in 1453, really well after the Crusades really meant anything, at least in the East, they pretty much destroyed a lot of the relics and Christian art of there that were in Constantinople. So the Hagia Sophia played this significant role as the center of Byzantine Christianity throughout the crusading period. For a time, you could argue it was a crusading church because of what I just described. And then after that, in 1261, it was restored to the East. And it was also the largest church in Christendom during that entire period, right? So that's another very significant thing.
So at that time, we were really talking about two epicenters for Christianity.
Right.
Major epicenters, Rome,
yes,
and Constantinople, and that Fourth,
right,
Crusade was essentially a Christian-on-Christian crusade.
Yes, it wasn't intended to be that. It didn't start out that way. Like I said, there's... And I think we did talk about the Fourth Crusade in that series I mentioned. So people could go back and look that up. It's kind of complicated, you know. As we see in the world today, these political affairs can get quite complicated. It's not always one against binary choices or one side and one side. You know, there's multiple factors involved. So, but yes, essentially it was a devastating thing to happen from the Christian perspective because it cemented the divide between East and West for centuries. In some ways, you could argue it still exists. That event really helped cement that divide that's continued in the Christian church.
So if you would, talk about the waning of the Crusades in the East and the rise of the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, that's a good question. Effectively, by the late 1200s, I would say the 1290s, there was no real Western Christian crusader presence in the Middle East, outside of some of the islands in the like Rhodes and Cyprus. But all the kingdoms that have been in the Middle East along the shore of the Mediterranean, what is basically modern-day Israel, Lebanon, parts of Syria, those areas, they had all been retaken by some Muslim force. You had the addition also of there were other Turkish groups that came into the Middle East constantly. So the Muslim guys weren't always united. You know, Arabs and Turks often fought each other. And then you had the arrival of the Mongols, which really brought the death knell to a lot of people. But most of those Mongols end up converting to Islam, although they conquered for a time and ruled most of the Middle East. Some of the Christians were hoping that the Mongols would actually might convert to Christianity or ally with them, but that didn't happen. So the Mongols actually conquered the whole Fertile Crescent area, modern-day Iraq, Syria, much of what would be Turkey. So, getting to the Ottoman Turks. A lot of the Ottoman Turks were then pushed west. And what becomes the Ottoman Turks were these Turkish warriors who were along the border in what today would be Western Turkey, close to Constantinople. And they considered themselves by the 13th and 14th century to be the Ghazi, which were spiritual warriors and physical warriors for Islam. And the Ghazi idea goes back to the, you know, jihad and all that. But they were conquerors, and it was that's where the Ottomans arose. Their original Ottoman guy was a ruler named Osman. And by the 1400s, they had emerged as the most powerful force in Western Turkey and then moved into Southern Europe. And then, as I said, in 1453, conquered Constantinople. And you really had the establishment, I would say, around that time as a real Ottoman Empire. And it grew, the Ottoman Empire continued to grow well into the what we would call the early modern period. And people have probably heard of this. You know, they attacked Vienna in 1529. They were again at Vienna in the next century in 1683. And they actually ruled a very large empire for hundreds of years that included European territories, Middle East, Asia territories, and North Africa. So very significant power.
And the presence of the Ottoman Turkish Empire kind of expanding its border into Western Europe,
yes,
was very important in the politics surrounding the Reformation. Tell us about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Frankly, it probably helped Luther and the Reformation succeed in a sense, because every time for lack of a better term, we'll say the Roman Catholic side, would try to enforce some rules against the Lutheran political princes in the Northern Europe or Central Europe, Germany, basically. The Turks would show, you know, the Turks would present a problem and they would need unity. So the Lutheran princes and Luther came to say, hey, it's okay to fight the Turks because they're attacking us. So we can join with the Roman Catholics against the Turks. And he said that's perfectly acceptable as long as you're fighting a just war against invaders. So that helped, I think, give the Reformation time to kind of practically grow as a social and political movement in Central and Northern Europe. There's no doubt about that.
So in essence, Charles V, the ruler of the Holy Roman Empire,
right,
at the time, he needed those German princes,
yes,
to hold off the Turkish Empire.
Yeah, without the additional armies, you know, it was touch and go. I mean, had the Turks won at Vienna in the late 1520s and early 1530s, I would say our history would be quite different. That's an instance when a battle probably really meant a lot. You know, you can't know from what might have happened. But had the Turks basically been able to invade all the way into Central and go west all the way, the Turkish Empire, at least, would have been much more influential and larger. As it happened, the Ottoman Turkish Empire never really got past what would be modern-day Hungary, or north of there either. So they did conquer much of what would be Eastern Europe, all of Southeastern Europe, but it never got far into Central Europe or north into Poland or what today would be France, you know, those kind of things.
And I'm sure that they were thinking at the time, especially when Vienna was under siege, that the Muslims already had a stronghold in Spain and Portugal and Northern Africa. That would have been pretty disastrous.
Well, by 1500, at least, Charles, you know, he controlled Spain. But North Africa, absolutely. I mean, North Africa was controlled by all of North Africa, almost all of it, was part of the Ottoman Empire at that time. So, yes, they could have, and there were naval battles throughout the Mediterranean. They were very famous naval battles. And pirates and groups like that could have easily, if they want to amass a force to attack, say, southern Spain and those areas, they easily could have done that. But, you know, on the other side, the Ottomans, they had problems, too. They had an Eastern Front themselves, and they were often fighting with their co-religionists, who were Shia Muslims in what today would be Iran. So the Persians and the Ottomans fought each other constantly in what today would be Iraq and eastern Iran. So they had other things to worry about, too. Remember, they were an empire that included, by that time, much of the Arabian Peninsula, Egypt, and all the way to the border of modern-day Iran. So they couldn't just concentrate on one thing either, and that probably played a role in, you know, ameliorating, balancing those things out.
With about a minute before our next break, what eventually happened to the Ottoman Empire?
Yes, well, that gets us up to pretty modern history. The Ottoman Empire, like a lot of the great empires of Eastern Europe and in the early modern period, lasted quite a long time. It ended because of World War I. The Ottoman Empire took the side, they joined in with the Central Powers, which were the German Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And they lost. So, I mean, we're talking about 102 years ago, 1918 is when that war ended. The final treaty to solidify what happened in the Middle East actually is less than 100 years. Its anniversary will be coming up in a couple years, 100-year anniversary. So we're talking about not that really long ago in the span of human history. So the Ottoman Empire collapses. You end up with Turkey is kind of the main political, I would say, descendant of the Ottoman Empire. But all the Middle East countries that we think about that are a lot of the hot spots, I guess you'd say today, Syria, Iraq, parts of what would be Saudi Arabia, Egypt, all those were once heartlands and major parts of the Ottoman Empire.
We're talking with Dr. Matt Phillips of Concordia University, Nebraska, about Christianity, Islam, and the history of the Hagia Sophia. We'll talk about its more recent history under a secularized Turkey next.
My plan is to talk about understanding the Ten Commandments through the lens of the passive and the active obedience of Christ.
Pastor Hans Feeney talking about his presentation at the 2020 Virtual Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
So one of the things I like to do when I teach my confirmation classes, both my youth confirmation and adult confirmation class, is to talk a lot about how it is that Christ fulfills all of these commandments for us and understanding what it means to keep these commandments through the lens of the way that Christ kept them for us from both the perspective of his active obedience, so his active keeping of the law, as well as his passive obedience, which is obeying the will of his Father and going to the cross.
You can watch Pastor Hans Feeney's teaching, Making the Case for the Obedience of Christ, at this year's Virtual Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference. Registration includes the ability to watch live and on demand. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran Confessions. By the book Liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at GraceLutheranRacine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues, Etc.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll begin our wrap-up of Romans. Christ, our exemplar. Christ, the hope of Jews and Gentiles, the offering of the Gentiles, the visit to Rome and Spain, and the long goodbye. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Hagia Sophia, Christianity and Islam, with Dr. Matt Phillips, professor of history at Concordia University, Nebraska. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about the establishment of the modern Republic of Turkey and what it meant for this building.
Right. So I just thought of something. Let me mention something about Hagia Sophia again. So it means holy wisdom, right? I'm not good with it. It's Greek for holy wisdom. The wisdom there is, there was actually a martyr named Sophia, but it has nothing to do with her. The wisdom there is the Logos, the eternal word of God, the second person of the Trinity, Jesus. So it's actually a cathedral dedicated specifically to Christ, the second person of the Trinity. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew what that meant. All right, let me talk about modern-day Turkey. So modern-day Turkey was established technically as a republic. The man who is, I'll make this comparison, the George Washington of Turkey, I guess. It was a man named Mustafa Kemal. He's known generally by his moniker Ataturk, which means father of the Turks. He was a colonel in the Imperial Army. He fought very bravely at the Battle of Gallipoli in 1915. He was one of the main officers defending Turkey from British Imperial attacks during World War II. So he's a very well-known guy. After the war ends in 1918, another war starts in Turkey because it was divided up by the Allies, and the Greeks, with British help, invade parts of Turkey. And Ataturk and other Turkish nationalists decide, no, we're not going to stand for that. So they defend, in their minds, they defend their country, and they end up winning. So that war leads to the Treaty of Lausanne, 1923. So Turkey really, as a modern state in that sense, is less than 100 years old. You can really trace it out of that time, and the world kind of recognized Turkey and as a result of the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. So Ataturk sets up this republic. Now, in reality, it was in many ways a military dictatorship, because Ataturk was president for life. They did have a parliament, and he was president, and they've had presidents and so forth since. But Ataturk lived till the late 1930s, and pretty much he called the shots. But key thing about Ataturk is he purposely wanted to westernize Turkey for the time. He put in very strict rules about the way people could dress. He banned traditional Muslim dress in many ways. He wore Western-style suits of the 1920s and 30s. He had a relationship with a woman who was not his wife publicly. And of course, you know, I'm not saying that was right personally, but I'm saying, like, it demonstrates his attitude that I'm not going to follow any religious convention, and I can do it. And so he purposely secularized Turkey, and this is very important because he wanted Turkey to be a more Western-oriented state and adopt what we would think more of separation of mosque and state, okay? So within Turkey, you have different political groups and so forth, but that is the tradition of Turkey, and the military traditionally played a big role in Turkey. Turkey also became a big ally of the United States during the Cold War, and that's why Turkey is still a part of the NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, right? So the United States in the 50s and 60s sold weapons. The United States has a base in Turkey with nuclear weapons on it, still today. So Turkey has played a big role in those kind of politics, too. But in more recent times, and this is what I was talking about Erdogan, I think is how you pronounce it, but he's the president, and he has a lot of his political base is more of the, I would say, for lack of a better term, Islamist, more pro, we want more influence of Islam in society, okay? And there's probably different, there's a spectrum of belief there, I'm sure. And the other side in Turkey, political side, tends to still follow the Ataturk tradition, which is we want Turkey to be closer to the West. Religion's fine, but we don't want this to be an Islamist society. So that's one of the big political divides in Turkey. Also, Erdogan has shown he's been a lot more aggressive militarily in Syria, and that's a mess. That's a whole nother, you could do weeks of shows with other people that are smarter than me about that. And he's also gotten involved in a situation in North Africa with Libya, which is also, now that's current right now. So, but those are all connected to, actions done by, I would say, the previous American administration. But so this is all mixed together in current politics. Again, as I started out the show, one of the reasons why I think, it's my opinion, and I think other people would agree with me, he's promoting this idea about the Hagia Sophia being a mosque is to shore up political support from his base, as this makes the more pro-Muslim groups in Turkey happy, right? You can see why it would make them happy. I'm not even questioning their motives. I understand it, right? Think about if there was a church, some famous Lutheran church, that had been turned into a museum, and all of a sudden, let's say the Wittenberg Church or something, and all of a sudden, in Germany, they said, you know what, this should be a Christian church again, and we're going to let Lutherans come there. And so you can kind of see how some people might think that's a good thing. On the other hand, right, it was originally a church for 1,000 years, right? So, or 900 years. And so the Russians are very upset about this. The Russian Orthodox Church has said something about it. The Greeks are not happy, and there's all kinds of problems with Greeks and Turks in modern period, too, going back to the War of 1919. The Greeks said they were going to sanction Turkey over this. I don't know what that means, but anyway. So that's a lot to say, and that puts us kind of in the context of what's going on with the Hagia Sophia currently.
You mentioned briefly before that although it has not been a church for hundreds and hundreds of years, there was a very brave Greek priest and some friends who managed to somehow get in to the Hagia Sophia while it was a mosque and actually celebrate the mass there. Tell us that story quickly.
I sent a message to a friend about, I was going to talk about this with you today, and he sent me this story. I've never seen this before. I'm not going to try to pronounce the guy's name, but it was some of this Greek military that were in Constantinople in 1919. Because Constantinople was pretty much occupied by the British Allied powers after World War I. So they were going through there, and this guy was a priest, a chaplain, Greek Orthodox priest, with these other pretty high-ranking military officials. And so they decided to go sneak in the Hagia Sophia, and they went in there, and he performed the Divine Liturgy with these guys there. And when they got through the whole liturgy, and then they left. And that, as far as I know, that's the only time where the divine service has been performed inside Hagia Sophia since 1453 to the present. But I just thought it was it's a fascinating story. I've never seen it before. But anyway, that was the story.
So much in our modern society is very young. Our architecture is very young. There are very few buildings as old as the one we've been talking about here. Give us, finally, an historian's perspective of being able to, you could, if you wanted to, travel to Turkey and actually stand under this tremendous dome that was once dedicated to Christ and had been for 900 years of its previous life, a Christian church.
This is one of the places I'd like to go. I wish I'd have tried to go there, before this time. Hopefully, if God will spare us and we'll figure out with God's grace, and our own reason that he's given us a way to deal with this virus and other things, we'll be able to travel again. If I can go there, if God gives me life and the ability to travel there, I would like to go to Istanbul and see this building. Yeah, it's an amazing building. I've had some students go there, in fact, and bring me back pictures. A lot of tour groups that will go to, like, Turkey and Greece for biblical tours will often go to Istanbul. So you probably have listeners that have been there and seen it. I have not personally seen it. I've looked at a lot of pictures. But, yes, I cannot imagine it. A person like me who loves looking at churches, I mean, and historical sites, that would be probably, you know, in the top three or so things that I would like to see. And a marvel of architecture, human ingenuity. It's been damaged by earthquakes over and over again and repaired, even by the Muslims later as a mosque. And that's good to know. I just hope, personally, that this doesn't become such a problem that somehow the building is harmed in some way, or some crazy person on any side of this issue decides to attack it or something. Obviously, people are more and more in the buildings. I get that. But, you know, this building is... It's not the pyramids as far as time-wise it has existed. But in my mind, personally, and as a historian, I see it on that level of significance.
Dr. Matt Phillips is professor of history at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, thank you very much for your time.
It was great to be here. Have a good day.
Dr. Kevin Golden joins us next. We're going to be talking with him about Old Testament matriarch Ruth. The church remembers her on the 16th of July.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused many Christians to ask about whether or not the government should be telling the church when and how to gather around our Lord's gifts. In the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Christopher Thoma takes up this question in his article titled, Executive Orders, Divine Command. To read this excellent article and more about the church's life in the midst of a pandemic, subscribe to the Lutheran Witness today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium snow. Epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow, across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scare, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.